Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the Punk Rock NBA Podcast.
What's up, everybody? I am Finn McKenty. This is the Punk Rock NBA Podcast. Today's guest is Nothing Nowhere. You may know him as one of the more popular, more kind of ahead of the curve, quote-unquote, emo rappers. Although, as we talk about in the show, he's a lot more than that. But, you know, that's the term people like to use, so I will use it too. And let me just say, this is a fucking great episode. Please, please stick around and listen to this one, whether you're a fan of his music or not. He is a super thoughtful guy. We talk about a lot of stuff in here that I'm extremely, extremely passionate about, and I really, really hope everybody listens to this one. We talk about mindfulness, about having compassion, about just kind of how to manage your own psychology, especially for those of you who deal with depression and anxiety and stuff like that. This is the important stuff that I actually care about more than anything else, more than music, more than business. Like, at the end of the day, it's about being a happy person and learning how to live in the moment and deal with the shit that we're all dealing with. And that is the focus of this episode. Really, really, really just can't say enough good things about how this one turned out. So before we get into it, though, I wanted to mention a couple ways that you can support the show if you would like to. Number one, you can share it on social media. That really helps us get the word out. Number two, you can pick up some merch. There's a link to that in the show notes. I got a bunch of cool new stuff, some mugs, a funny, edgy slogan and impact font shirt that is so far selling really well. By my good friend Michael Cortada, who's an amazing artist. And lastly, you can support us on Patreon if you would like to do that. Patrons get the shows early. There's a private members-only Discord server. There's a way to have me review your stuff. Lots of cool stuff happening over on Patreon, so you can check that out at the link in the show notes as well if you would like to. But first, before we get into that, let's do a little bit of Q&A. From X, Dirk, and Lisa, just stumbled across last year's Lionheart album. Awesome stuff and very honest lyrics about mental health and struggles. Would you want to do an episode on mental health and hardcore? I don't know that, like, doing a video about mental health and hardcore makes sense. That's kind of like a really niche topic. But you'll notice that I do talk about this topic a lot in my videos in general, because I think it's kind of a common thread in all this music that we're increasingly becoming aware of. You know, I've joked about this a million times, but it's true. You don't get into hardcore and metal and stuff like that because everything is great, right? Like, you don't start listening to bands called Cannibal Corpse or Hatebreed or Death Threat, you know, because you're like a chill, normal, happy person. There's something, you know, there's something wrong in your life that makes this stuff appealing to you, whether that's mental health or, you know, dealing with some kind of shit at home or whatever it is. Like, there's a reason you're attracted to this darkness. And so that is something that I feel like is an important topic. One thing in particular that I would say that I've become increasingly aware of over the years is how many people who I used to think of as just kind of like eccentric characters were actually really mentally ill. And obviously, in my opinion, at least, and obviously I don't want to name any specific people here because it's not my place to diagnose anyone. But, you know, you think about certain people in the scene who are known for doing kind of wild stuff or just strange things or whatever. And maybe we thought, like, oh man, he or she's just so wild and crazy. But if you think about it, you know, in hindsight, you're like, well, actually, maybe that person was, like, you know, schizophrenic or, you know, doing so many drugs that they're effectively, you know, in the same place that they're, you know, they're experiencing psychosis that is functionally similar to schizophrenia. And maybe that's why this person was doing so many wild things. And if you view it through that lens, maybe it's not like a funny meme. Maybe it's actually kind of sad and scary. And this is somebody that we should want to help or be scared of, you know, or both. You know, I think oftentimes it's both. And that's a whole other kind of, you know, I talked about this in my Straight Edge video. That's kind of a whole other dynamic of, like, you can be sympathetic to someone while also holding them accountable for their actions. And I think especially in hardcore, that's kind of the way to look about it, to look at it. Because, you know, in hardcore, it's a little bit different than other genres where, like, violence is a much bigger thing. You know, emo and pop punk are not very violent. Hardcore does get pretty violent. And so you have to hold people accountable for their behavior, no matter what is going on, you know, with your mental health or addiction or trauma you may have been through or anything like that that's causing you to be this, like, you know, aggressive, violent, scary, unpleasant person. We can be compassionate and understand why they act this way, but we also hold them accountable for their actions, because at the end of the day, you know, no matter what, you are responsible for the choices you make. So I don't know if any of that is what you were looking for. I probably wouldn't ever do a specific episode about mental health and hardcore, but mental health in, you know, in its role in the alternative music scene is something that I will continue to talk about. And with that out of the way, let's get into this episode. Joe, welcome to the show. I always feel weird calling people by their rap names. Like back when I would do graffiti, you know, people would be like, "Hey, what's up? This is my boy Lost One." I'd be like, "Oh, is it Brad? Nice to meet you."
Yeah, no, I'm not cool enough to like just go by nothing nowhere. So Joe is fine.
It would be a power move though if you did that. Like if you go to like Chipotle, you know, and they ask you for your name, that'd be a power move.
Yeah, I don't know. I should start doing that for sure.
I think so. Nobody's gonna take you seriously until you do. You gotta show them who's boss.
Yes, well, sir.
I wanted to say I found you, like, I don't know what it was, 4 or 5 years ago through I'm Sorry I'm Trying, at a time when I was having a very, very, very hard time with depression. And I would say that that song describes, you know, the way that I felt, at least, better than anything else I've ever heard, to the point where now I can't really listen to it because it's like just it's just too hard to hear. Which isn't really a question, but thank you for that. And I think a lot of other people probably feel the same way.
Oh, dude, thanks. It always makes me like very happy, and it feels like I'm doing something worthwhile when, you know, people find some solace within my music that way. Cause, you know, I was certainly going through it when I made that song as well.
Yeah. Well, on that note, you seem like you're in a good place now. Am I imagining things, or is that kind of where you're at, or tell me about that?
Yeah, I would say that's an accurate assessment. I had to do a lot of work. It's been, you know, probably like 5 years with the Nothing Nowhere journey, and it's been ups and downs. But for the most part, I mean, where I'm at now, I think I'm miles ahead of where I was in terms of my mental health even 2 years ago. But that was through a lot of work that I had to do for sure.
Is it hard? I guess my thought would be, you know, if I had made your music and had gotten to a better place, which I have too, it would be hard for me to go back to playing the stuff that I made 4 or 5 years ago when I was in the shit. Is that something you deal with at all?
Yeah. For lack of a better word, I don't know if this is too much of a, but I feel like some of the songs are like triggering for me because they're so raw and visceral, and they connect me to a time where I was really not doing well. Just so full disclosure, like really bad panic attacks and depression, stuff like that. And it's hard to relive that sometimes. And so I have to sort of distance myself from the music for a while. And, you know, when I'll start on a tour, or if we're getting ready for a live stream or something, it's like, okay, like it's definitely draining, but I feel like I can separate myself from those songs if I like almost act like it's a story and then it wasn't reality. So yeah, no, it's rough sometimes for sure.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, you were very early to this currently popular style of music, whatever you want to call it. I would say like you and Bones were probably among the very first that at least I'm aware of. What was it like when you were doing that back in, you know, 2015 or so? I mean, you were kind of charting new territory back then. Were you sort of operating in a vacuum, or, you know, did you have peers, I guess, to bounce ideas off, or what was it like back then? Very different world than making that same music today.
Yeah, extremely different. It was very fresh. It was very new. You know, when someone heard a song like that, they would be like, "I have never heard this type of music before." And they were a lot more stoked on it. Whereas today, you know, in 2021, they're like, "Oh, it's It's an another emo one of rap those guys. Yeah. It felt like, you know, like Hyperpop is now, or like when 100 Gex came out. It was just one of those moments where it was
like, what the fuck is this?
Totally. Yeah. And it was, I wouldn't say it was a vacuum. I mean, SoundCloud, isn't really the SoundCloud community. Maybe I just aged out of it, but it was very active then.
Right.
And there was like an underground scene, like, and there were a lot of producers and artists, so many people just doing, I remember like, so Wiccaphase was going in, Corbin, who was going by Spooky Black, was pumping out stuff. And it just felt like the Wild West. And it's kind of a bummer now that it's so saturated, but that's the way things go. You know what I mean? If something is, you know, going, then like people are like, I want to get in on this, you know?
Right. Well, you've talked a lot in interviews and stuff about your influence as far as like, you know, older emo and stuff like that. But what I was wondering about is like, where does the rap and R&B side of things come in? Cause you have like a very good R&B voice, I think. And, you know, you're, I would say, much better at that stuff than most people in your kind of genre. So I feel like you probably go kind of deep there too.
Yeah, it is weird. People definitely prefer to ask me about kind of the emo post-hardcore stuff that I was into. Maybe that's just like the target audience or whatever, but I feel like simultaneously, like growing up super into rap and R&B, like, you know, my mom used to play like Return of the Mac in the car, like Mark Morrison. My sister is huge into R&B and stuff like that. And when I was younger, growing up in Foxborough, Massachusetts, just like a boring suburb in Massachusetts outside of Boston, we had a couple friends from Boston that we would make beats for, and we would do like emo hip hop crossover stuff in like 2010 with them. We never thought it would go anywhere. We were completely wrong. Never put anything out. I definitely think they got me more into rap and R&B and stuff like that. Cause I remember I was at Dairy Queen once. We rented out a local VFW venue and put up flyers around, and we would do like rap shows or whatever. And I was at a Dairy Queen after the show, and I was with my friend E, and he pulled up to this dude and was like, hey, if I beat you in like a rap battle, you have to buy my mixtape. And he obliterates the guy. And I just remember.
Was this just some random civilian, or was it some other like rapper guy?
Just completely random. Yeah. So I remember he like obliterated him. And I remember that I was like, that was the coolest thing I've ever seen. I was probably like 15 or something. And I was like,
she's like, dude, we're in 8 Mile.
Exactly. Yeah. I was like, this is it. We're doing it. And I don't know. I just remember being captivated by that. And it was a lot similar to when I first heard someone play like acoustic guitar for the first time and was like, oh, I want to like get into that. So yeah, like, I mean, the background's there. I loved Wu-Tang, De La Soul, Tribe Called Quest, MF Doom, Del the Funky Homo Sapien. You know, I just love all different types of music.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that, you know, your latest album is probably a good example of this. Like, I feel like we're in a post-genre kind of world where, you know, people like you can do everything from an emo song to a rap song. You have, I forget the name of it, but there's a screamy kind of song on there. And it all kind of works. It doesn't feel forced. It just feels like you can be fluid now.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. And I think, I don't know. I think the album sort of plays like my Spotify likes, which I've said before. And I don't think people are ingesting albums in the same way anymore because there's just too much music.
Right.
There's too much music. Our attention spans are nowhere near what they used to be. And I think the philosophy is shifting and genre elitists are sort of, you know, falling by the wayside, which I think is rad. I don't know if everyone else does.
Well, I think it's cool that artists have permission now to just do whatever the fuck they want. And I don't think, at least I don't see fans really, at least the, you know, the decent ones, have any issue with that. They're like, oh, I wish he would just stick with one thing. Like, nobody says that.
Yeah, there's always like the select few that do. But I think like the overwhelming majority are just kind of cool. If I'm thinking my own fan base, they're just cool with me doing whatever, which is very relieving as someone who makes music. because if I was facing all this pressure to like do the same song like 100 times, I'd probably lose my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's super relieving and it doesn't matter anymore. Like MGK had a number one album, just decided to do pop punk and his fans didn't care.
And then he just did that rap song with like, or kind of trap metal-y song with Corpse.
Yeah. Corpse. Yeah.
You know, he's just like, I'm just gonna do whatever the fuck I want.
Yeah. It's rad. I feel like it's like, cause everyone has access to just doing whatever at their home too. Like, I don't know, that you don't have to be in a specific scene. You don't have to be, there's no like regional sound anymore. There's
right.
Just everything's been broken down.
Like Russian kids doing Memphis rap.
Yeah, straight up. It's huge over there.
Do you know how that happened?
Suicide Boys, probably.
And did they tour over there or something? Or like why?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Like, so Bones and Suicide Boys are like really big over there. And I'd say Puya and the Buffet Boys are really big over there. That's my theory, I guess. But they got really into that.
Because it's like half the comments on all their videos are in Russian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They love that. Russians love that dark kind of like Ghost Mane vibe for sure.
I mean, they do it well. I guess I can understand why it would appeal to them. But yeah, I feel like this started happening kind of in the MySpace days when people started having access to just at a click, like vast amounts of music in all kinds of different genres. Like I remember bands back then would start, you know, listing their genre as a joke as like deathcore, crunk,
yep,
R&B or whatever. And it was a joke then, but now that's what people actually do, you know?
No, totally. Yeah, yeah. And now I was one of those MySpace kids putting my emo covers up on my page. And, you know, I had friends and yeah. And it's just cool that it's like, it's gone so far now that like, I don't know. People are always going to call me emo rapper, nothing nowhere, which is like, I don't have a say in that. And I've learned to just be like, oh, whatever. That's just what people are going to do. But for people to like not care if I make like a whatever genre song, is like super liberating.
I mean, I feel like you could, if you put out a song or even a whole album of like anything, I feel like you have permission to do that. Permission by the fans, I mean, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's probably limits, extreme limits that I would never touch. Like, you know, it'd probably be a little culturally inappropriate to put out like a reggae album, but
you won't know until you try it.
I mean, I think it's like an exciting time. And like, I've been working on a lot of like heavier music. It's just fun. I don't know. Like, that's just why I made music in the first place, is to have fun.
Well, talk about signing to Fueled by Ramen. You're obviously a smart guy. You could do all this on your own, I'm sure, but you chose to sign with a label. What was your thought process there?
Yeah, so no one in my scene had really done the label route at the time when I signed.
This was like 2017-ish?
Yeah, I'd say 2017, yeah. It was early, maybe late 2016 when I was talking to Equal Vision as well. A lot of people in the SoundCloud community were extremely anti-label, which there's a lot of merit and there's a lot of like, I understand that philosophy. But at the same time, I think that a lot of kids were just anti-label because it was just an echo chamber. They didn't really have any concrete reasoning as to why they didn't want to sign a contract. It was just like, label's bad, DIY good, you will lose all your money type thing. I wanted to be very selective on what kind of label I joined, and I was open to the idea of signing to a label because I had a moment where I was just in my parents' basement or whatever. And I was like, I just want to make music for a career forever. I don't want to have to like get some job that I don't want to do when I'm older. I don't want that for me. So from my perspective, the easiest way to do that was to get a lot of money from a record label and consistently be on a contract that will pay you for making albums. And at the time, I mean, it was a gamble, you know what I mean? I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know if what I was doing was sustainable. And I had some, you know, labels approaching me that was like, hey, we'll give you X, Y, and Z for doing what you do. And
right. At that time, it was very unclear that this sort of music had any kind of upside.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it was the Wild West. No one knew if there was any like commercial sort of success in on the horizon for the genre.
I do think it's interesting how long, I mean, you know, Epitaph signed everybody, you know, in like late 2019, which I'm glad they did, but I feel like the labels took a really long time to kind of come around to this stuff. Like they missed the boat by a couple of years.
Yeah, that's usually how it goes. The genres will be around for a long time and artists will be around for a long time until those people gets on. But I mean, who knows? Maybe they could have known, but it was kind of like a stock, like the stock was maybe too volatile or something.
Right, right.
So yeah. And I met with so many different labels. Like I met with all the majors too that were like, we'll give you so much money for doing this. And but at the same time, it was like terrible 360 deals. I didn't want to be shelved.
And yeah, you don't want to be priority number 47.
No.
For Universal.
No, like I don't want to fall behind like Ariana Grande or like I'm like backup times 100 quarterback. So I'd be sitting on the bench for sure. And Fueled By was like that happy medium, you know, and I just like the people there.
Yeah.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.
But first, I want to thank DistroKid for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. If you're not familiar, DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that musicians use to put their music into online stores and streaming services. So in plain language, if you have ever wondered how to get your music on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Deezer, Tidal, and many, many more, there's like dozens and dozens of different streaming services, DistroKid is the way to do it. It is super easy. I have used it to put my music on Spotify. It took me maybe 5 minutes to like set it up and upload everything. It's legitimately awesome. I am sincerely a fan of this company and their product. And for those of you who have asked, you can also upload your music to TikTok with DistroKid. And if you want a chance to get featured on DistroKid's Spotify playlists, you can do that by submitting a song through Spotlight and getting your fans to vote for you. You can also use Hyperfollow to get more Spotify followers. You can promote your new release as well as Spotify Canvas. That's where there's the video in the background in the player. And when you share it on Instagram, it shares that video too to make your Spotify release pop. And Spotify Canvas is available to all DistroKid artists. Like I said, as you can probably tell from this, like I am sincerely a fan of DistroKid. DistroKid can do everything I just talked about and so much more. So be sure to sign up with my link, which is in the show notes for this episode, to get 7% off your first year. That link is in the show notes of this episode, or go to distrokid.com/VIP/thepunkrockNBA. And thanks again to DistroKid for sponsoring this episode. I also wanted to ask you about the, I read some other interviews you did about the name of the album, Trauma Factory, and kind of the, I guess, the Buddhist philosophy behind some of that. And could you explain that really quickly for anybody who may have not have heard you talk about it?
Yeah, totally. Trauma Factory was the name of the album that I came up with. Essentially, it ties into one of the main staples of Buddhism, which is like, you know, suffering is the human condition. Suffering is a part of life. And that could be viewed negatively, I guess, by a lot of people. But from my perspective and from the perspective of Buddhism, it's not a negative thing. It's a positive thing because it harbors more compassion. It teaches you to realize that every single person you come in contact with all day has their own journey and their own suffering that they're going through. So your planetary companions become your fellow sufferers, and human life is a trauma factory. Yes, it is. But you need the yin for the yang. There's some beauty in that, I feel like.
I really liked that because now, I mean, I have a doctor's appointment on Monday. I've been going through some kind of health stuff recently, which, cross my fingers, I think may not end up being serious, but
yeah,
it also might be serious. And either way, I found myself kind of shocked at how just the fact that I may have this condition made me like instantly so much more empathetic towards people with like all kinds of disabilities and stuff that I, you know, I mean, I knew that these people existed, but I didn't really like internalize it, you know, to the point of like, wow. And like when I would go to the supermarket, I'd think, I wonder how many of the people here are dealing with something like this, you know, yeah. And you would never know it from looking at them and how that affects their life. And it just made me so much more empathetic instantly. And I'm not going to say I'm glad that I'm going through this, but there's a part of me that was like, you know, this has really helped me grow a lot already. And there's a part of me that's like, I don't know, not glad, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, dude, I hope that all pans out and, you know, fingers crossed that things are all right.
But if it doesn't, that's okay too, because this is the human condition. You know, I remember listening to bands like Shelter and stuff when I was a kid, getting into like Krishna consciousness and stuff. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, birth, sickness, old age, and death. This is the path we're all on, you know? And I know that's like a heavy thing, but especially as I get older, it's like I'm watching my body age. That's just the way it goes.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a testament to the power of mindfulness and living in the present moment. Another thing with Buddhism and Taoism that I'm obsessed with, I love is, you know, I do mindfulness meditation to always bring myself to the present moment, because you never know what's going to happen. And the future doesn't exist. The past doesn't exist. The only thing that's tangible and real is the present moment. And, you know, to your point of being at the grocery store and just not knowing what people go through, is like, people are harboring so much weight. They're carrying so much. You know, it's astounding. And we tend to forget that, I feel like. And it's sad, but it is, it's healthy. And it's a beautiful thing to like not lash out and not be angry at others, because if someone wrongs me, I'm like, they must be suffering. They must be hurt. What led them to take that path? Are they coping in a negative way?
Sure. Their kid might have cancer. They might be stressed the fuck out because their kid is in surgery tomorrow.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why they were an asshole to you at Starbucks.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you knew that, you couldn't be mad at them.
No way. Yeah. So like unconditional compassion is huge. How do you love your biggest quote unquote enemy or something?
I'm not saying I'm some, you know, super enlightened person that's transcended this stuff, because I have my moments just like anyone else, but
same.
I find it really hard to be angry at people now because of that.
Yeah, that's amazing. And to your point, I feel like I had a very similar experience. You know, I'd lost 25, 30 pounds through anxiety and was having really scary, almost like just these weird symptoms. And I was really going through it mentally. And I just had, during that time, I had so much compassion towards others, because I guess we forget, we get on, you know, cruise control, and we're like, everyone must feel like I do, because I'm okay.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I'm trying, you know, cross my fingers, let's say that everything's okay. I'm trying to remember and like stay in that moment of like high empathy. You know, even if everything's okay for me, I want to stay in that moment and remember that, you know, for the rest of my life.
Yeah, that's huge. And that's like amazing that you have that mindset. Maybe it comes with age or just like who you are as a person. But unfortunately, some people, they don't think that way. But it's just great that we do. You know what I mean?
Well, that's why I'm so glad that you, you know, are talking about this in the context of the album and the name and everything, because it was, you know, partly because of my mom, because she was into that stuff, but also because of, you know, because of Shelter, that I started learning about Krishna consciousness when I was a kid. And I'm not like a Krishna, but the stuff that I learned from that like really stuck with me. And it's because I didn't listen when my mom told me the same shit, because I was 15. But when a band told me, I'm like, oh, well, if a guy in a band says it, it must be true.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate, but that's how kids think. And so I'm really glad. This is like a very high level but very, very, very important message that you're talking about. And like, nobody talks about this stuff, at least in our culture. So I'm really happy to see that you are.
Yeah, man. And I totally, like, I remember, like, you know, Cro-Mags and stuff like that.
Exactly.
You know, like John Joseph into the Krishna stuff. And, you know, one of my all-time favorite bands is Have Heart. And Have Heart was always talking about, you know, PMA and just being a better person and just like using your best foot forward. And that was something, and it still is something that I'm really grateful that I had growing up. And I wish that more kids had that experience, because yeah, we don't always listen to our parents when we're younger.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I found interesting is that unlike a lot of your peers, you know, when dealing with mental health stuff, it sounds like you never got into like drugs or anything like that to deal with it.
No, yeah, I've been straight edge my whole life. And well, I tried smoking weed when I was 14 and I had a panic attack and I hated it.
It sucks. It's the worst.
Yeah, I don't like it. It works great for some people. So since I've been 14, I've been straight edge. And yeah, I've never been drunk. I don't know what that feels like. I always like ask my friends, like, what does it feel like to be drunk?
It's like taking a hard fall when you skateboard.
Yeah, I guess, which I did yesterday and is not cool. I think I saw the negative effects of, you know, alcoholism and addiction sort of at a young age with certain people. And I saw the culture, the party culture when I was in high school. And I just didn't, it didn't speak to me. It annoyed me. It made me angry and confused. And I just decided from a young age, I wanted to find a different way to cope with the stress of life. And I directed my attention towards, you know, making videos and songs and stuff like that.
Well, I'm happy to hear that because, you know, knowing how hard things were for you a couple years ago, imagine how much worse it would be if you're also dealing with addiction on top of that. I mean, that's what kills people.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And so when I was younger, I was very ignorant towards addiction and alcoholism. And I can say that now. I didn't understand. I was like, yo, these people who are using are, you know, why are they doing that? Like, they're just ruining themselves. Like, I don't understand it. And, you know, it came with age. I was like, people are suffering and they're looking for coping mechanisms. And when I was at my worst, I refused for so many years to get on antidepressants, to get on anything. And I got to a point where I was like, I would do anything not to feel this way. I would do heroin not to feel this way. So I went to a psychiatrist and I was like, yeah, like give me the antidepressants.
Give me the heroin.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, that's not what we do here.
Yeah. She's like,
shoot me up in the neck, doc.
Yeah. No, but I mean, that was a big moment for me too, where I was just like, oh my God. And then being very, very close with someone who struggles with addiction, people just want to feel okay. And it gets so bad that you'll do anything to feel okay.
I mean, like my mom was an alcoholic and, yeah, you know, she, and it's super obvious to me, especially now as an adult, why. I mean, her mom died when she was 7, her dad died when she was 14, her brother killed himself when she was 20 and she found him, you know, wow. And it's like, well, of course she's a fucking mess.
Yeah.
Like who wouldn't be?
Yeah, that's gnarly. That is gnarly. How do you cope with stuff like that? How?
Yeah, I mean, that's going to fuck anybody up. And that's why, like, people getting judgmental about addicts is, you know, hard to see, because it's like, dude, if you went through that, you would do the same thing. Anybody would.
Anybody would. I mean, the pain gets to a certain point where it's like, I can't do it. You know, I need an out.
Yeah, you just can't.
Yeah. And it's sad. It's super sad.
So with mindfulness, for anybody who is sort of interested and may have heard that term and thinks, all right, well, maybe I should look into that. What do you have any suggestions for where they might start?
Yeah, sure. I think a great place to start, in my opinion, would be the Headspace app, simply because they really nail the basics of naming and noting your emotions. Like it's not so avant-garde and so pretentious. It's really just, you know, step-by-step how to sit in contemplation. And just if you have a thought come into your mind, you're like, oh, I'm thinking. If you feel something, you say, oh, I'm feeling. And it's guided meditation. So I would recommend getting into some guided meditations. I would recommend Headspace, but it's really hard to just get into meditation and just sit there because we have what Buddhists call
it's so hard.
Yeah, monkey mind. I mean, you're
so hard, like yeah. sitting there for 30 seconds and with a calm, peaceful mind,
yeah.
not thinking about anything is so hard.
Yeah. So when I'm a huge fan of Punk Rock MBA. I watch every video, I listen to podcasts, and you strike me as someone who is super ambitious, always going, like really like doing everything you can to move your brand forward. Like, do you take the time ever? Like what's your relationship with meditation?
Oh yeah. I have spent, for anybody listening, like all of the things you said is true, but I have spent more time and energy on managing my own psychology over the years than anything else combined. Like since I was like 14, because my mom was super into this stuff. She did a daily practice called A Course in Miracles, which has a dumb hippie name, but it's awesome. She got me a book by this guy named Paramahansa Yogananda when I was a kid, who's like a sort of Krishna guy. And I have practiced all that stuff since I was 14. And that's the foundation for everything. Like, you can't be successful in business or relationships or anything like that without that foundation of having your head in the right place. And I'm not saying that mine is always in the right place, because it's not, but man, I have come so fucking far.
Yeah.
You know, and it's only because I think about that every minute of every day. Like, there's never a moment where I just let my mind run wild.
Yeah, that's huge. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. I had a hunch that you were into it, because I feel like it's not sustainable to be so ambitious without, you know, checking all of the boxes. You know, I've often said, like, I'm like a Toyota Camry with like 300,000 miles. Like I have to like really like do my maintenance to keep moving, you know?
Yeah. And I'm very aware that I could accomplish more than I have if I wanted to. Like I could start a company, you know, that ended up being worth tens of millions of dollars in a couple years and get funding for it and all that shit. I'm 1,000% confident I could do that. And it might sound like a cop out or something, but I've chosen not to, because I know that that would come at the cost of my mental health and, you know, well-being basically.
Yeah.
That would be a stupid choice for me to make.
Yeah, I've had similar experiences with offers and stuff like that, where I'm like, you know, on paper, and you know, you really want to do something, but the reality of it is no amount of money or whatever is really gonna replace, you know, like your mental health. Like,
absolutely, which sounds obvious, but people make trade-offs in favor of, I mean, a thing I've been thinking about a lot lately is materialism. Mm-hmm. And just how much everybody, including me, makes trade-offs in favor of material shit at the cost of their, like, you know, mental or spiritual well-being, and just how stupid that is. And I'm not looking down on that. It's like, we all do it.
Yeah.
You know, it's same. Like, what you're working so that you can like buy some shit you don't even really care about at the cost of not seeing your family. Like, what the fuck are we doing?
Yeah. I'm totally like, you know, I'm a mess. You know what I mean? Like I'm not like some like enlightened being or anything like that. And totally, like, I do it all the time, you know, and then you get the thing and you're like, oh, what the fuck? Like, it happened again. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, you get that little dopamine hit for like literally 5 seconds.
Literally. Yeah. And you forget. And then your brain, I mean, you know, maybe it's like living under like a capitalist society or like a Western society where people are screaming at you, and your value is, you know, how good you are as a person is based on like your monetary accomplishments. And we've been screamed at.
Well, I think that system is a product of our biological programming, because we're optimized for a resource scarce environment,
yep.
where you had to potentially be willing to kill somebody over a piece of meat.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We don't live in that world anymore. We live in a resource abundant world, but our brains are programmed, our mental algorithm is optimized for a resource scarce environment. I think that's the root of a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very, very good point. Sort of like the technology in society has blown past our biological sort of evolution. And we are these like monkeys with access to everything.
Yeah, it's like putting a dog at the fucking controls of a 747. It's like, whoa, I'm a dog. What do I do with this?
Yeah, we're idiots. We're still primates. You know what I mean? And it's fascinating. And it's just fascinating. I think it was like Schopenhauer who was talking about like, you know, dancing hopelessly into like the arms of death. Just always becoming and wanting and just never being. And that's exactly. a very bizarre, exactly. the human condition. And I can't, that's been the hardest thing for me ever is to shake that. Like I have a home now, I have money for food, I have everything. And I know through reading Buddhism and Taoism and all of that, that I don't need anything else, but my brain is always screaming at me like you need more.
Exactly. And so to your point about ambition and stuff, I very consciously push back on that part of my brain because for whatever reason, that part of my brain screams louder than it does for some other people.
Yeah.
But I try to keep that in check for that exact reason. And, you know, on that note, you said earlier that you wanted to do music for the rest of your life, which I'm sure you'll be able to if you want to. But you also seem like the kind of person where, you know, I could imagine reading a headline in 2 years where it's like, you know, nothing nowhere quits music to be a maple syrup farmer and nobody ever hears from you again. And you're like, nah, I'm good. I just got this maple syrup company. Is that something that you like? Am I off base there? Or?
Yeah, no, I fantasize about that for sure. And I also,
For anybody who doesn't know, you live in Vermont and you make maple syrup. So I didn't just pull that out of nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely my life. I do fantasize about that, especially, you know, I have these conversations with people who's like, you know, this guy the other day was like, yeah, we do $300,000 a year in sap. And I'm like, oh, and you're tapping trees. That sounds very relaxing. There's no one screaming at you that you need to make a hit when you're tapping trees. I think that would be true. However, I have this piece of me that needs music and I've tried to quit music in the past and I know it's not possible for me. It's just not possible. I think yeah. I need to be making music, but do I need to be paid for making music? That remains to be seen. I just know that I hate 9-to-5s enough to want to avoid them. This is what I'm the best at, I feel like. And to be paid for what you're the best at makes the most sense to me, but it gets real stressful. That's for sure.
Yeah. I sometimes think about the same thing. And I would imagine, you know, anything that I kind of deal with as far as like the mental health side of being in the public eye, you know, is 10 times bigger for you. I kind of fundamentally don't think that being a public figure is healthy.
No. Absolutely not. I don't see the benefit in it. I see the benefit in it is obviously the connection you make with others and you're enriching people's lives. Not that I do anything special. I just make songs, but to for people to say, hey, this changed my life is really special. And I have a platform now where I can work in tandem with charities and I can really do my best to create like substantive change. But I heard like Russell Brand or someone talking about how fame is.
Oh, dude, he's brilliant. I love him.
He is, just a brilliant, loquacious, very seasoned vocabulary.
Dude, he just fucking goes for like 12 minutes saying stuff that's smarter than anything I've said in my life.
And it's unbelievable. And a lot of people write him off because they just remember him from, you know, Get Him to the Greek or whatever, they don't understand. But he was talking about how, you know, fame is a flavorless broth. It brings absolutely nothing to the table. I'm not even famous. I just, people know who I am. And it's another one of those things that our monkey minds just really clamor onto. When I was younger, I was like, if I had this, I would be happy. But at the end of the day, we're trying to fill the void with external things that we believe is going to make us whole again, which is never going to happen. And some people never learn that and they do it all the way until they die. surprise, surprise, like, you know, fame, money, whatever, never brought you happiness in the first place. It's the relationships you have with others and with yourself.
Yep. 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 I remember, you know, there was some Downset song that I heard, you know, when I was a kid that was talking about this, like, you can, you know, have all the sex in the world and do all the drugs in the world, but it's, you know, it's, and have all the money in the world, it's not going to make you happy. And I was too young to really understand that at the time. But, you know, as I've gotten older and tried to fill that void in so many different ways, and it's like, oh, okay, all those people who told me this because they'd been through it, I guess they were right.
Yeah. I guess we always like to learn things the hard way. Like, we can never take someone's word for it. We can never be like, okay, you know, we got to go through the trenches.
I mean, imagine how fucked up it is to be actually famous. Like, the kind of person who can't go to the fucking grocery store.
No. And I have friends that are actually famous and, you know, paparazzi and stuff like that. And I just, it's when I see them and I see that they are handling it, and I'm like, you are, that is unbelievable. You know, like, it's, you have to be a certain type of person, I think, for sure, to be able to deal with that.
I mean, you see, like, what a mess a lot of these, like, Disney stars, the people who were Disney stars when they were like 10, you know, became later in life. And it's like, well, no shit, Jesus.
Yeah. I mean, everything you do is under a microscope. You can't just be a person. There's no, you don't, your personal freedoms are stripped from you. And I would just be paranoid. I'd probably fucking lose my mind, honestly.
Can't trust anyone.
No. I mean, yeah, every single relationship you have, you'll be questioning it. And that is not a normal thing to do at all. You know, like, who has ulterior motives, you know, always.
Yeah. Is that why you live in Vermont? Kind of, I mean, I'm sure that the ideal thing for your career would be to live in LA and, you know, be close to everyone and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. If I was in LA, I know for a fact, like, things would be much, much easier and smooth sailing. I'd be in sessions every day. I'd be in X, Y, and Z. I'd be plugged in, but I can't do it. I can't. I need to be in the woods. I need to have my safe place that I can go to. Because if I'm somewhere like that in a city, I am always nothing, nowhere, making music. I'm never me. I'm never Joe. And I'm never, you know, connecting with the earth and feeling any type of tranquility, which I need for sure.
I think about that a lot too, of like, you know, sometimes we've talked about moving to California, and every time I'm like, nope, because then I'm going to be stressed the fuck out because I spent 4 hours in traffic to go meet with somebody about something, and I'm just going to constantly feel like I'm chasing a ball and I never get the ball, and I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, it's a rat race for sure. And I'm out there enough, you know, pre-COVID, like, I was always out there for sessions and meeting with people, whatever, but I always know when I'm on my trip that I'm about to take a plane home in, you know, 4 days, and I get to go home to, you know, the woods. And that is
your trees.
Yeah, that's what saves me for sure. Cause if I didn't have that out, I would be, you know, my mind would be a mess.
Yeah. All right. Well, I've taken up enough of your time. I really appreciate you carving out a few minutes for this. Is there any words of wisdom or anything else you want to leave people with before I let you go?
What we were talking about, be kind to others, because you never know what they're going through. And just keep an open mind and stay in the present. And I'm just an idiot who makes music, so don't take that advice, you know. But yeah, that's it.
Cool. Well, I appreciate it.
Sick.
All right, my friends, that does it for this episode of the podcast. If you made it this far, thank you. Thank you for listening. We sincerely appreciate each and every one of you. If you want to help the show, there's a couple things that you can do. First of all, share it on social media. If you share it, tag us, tag Finn McKenty, that's me, and tag Deanna Chapman, that's a producer. Second thing you can do, if you really, really, really love us and really want to support us, you can support us on Patreon. There's a link to that in the show notes. You can leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening to this, or you can do none of that. And you can just sit at home, think about how awesome this podcast is. That works too. Again, thank you very much to each and every one of you for listening. We sincerely appreciate it, and we'll see you next time.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
Chumba. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, this is Aaron from No Simple Road. I'm inviting you to come hang out with Apple, Mel, and I as we talk with the musicians, artists, chefs, authors, and beyond from the world that turns us on. We're reaching into the improvisational music scene, the psychedelic culture, the festival world, and getting to know what makes the people tick that create those scenes. Come join us on the long, strange trip over at No Simple Road.